Hi, I'm Susan Swain, host of C-SPAN's Q&A, where we spend an hour with nonfiction writers and historians who add context to today's news. Journalist Andrew Rice, contributing editor at New York Magazine, theorizes that the year 2000 is the year that broke America. He's published a new book by that title in which he recounts the events of that year, which started with a fear of a global computer meltdown and ended with a battle over one of the closest presidential elections in U.S. history. In between, the Elian Gonzalez Cuban immigration crisis captured the headlines, Donald Trump first ran for president, and Al-Qaeda operatives arrived in the U.S. to learn to fly.
Andrew Rice, your new book is titled The Year That Broke America. It's about the year 2000. What's the central idea in the book?
Well, the idea is that basically that the year 2000 was an unlikely turning point in American history, or in retrospect, was a much bigger year in American history than was recognized at the time. The book has, you know, five different plot lines, but the two main ones are the 2000 election, which was decided by the closest margin imaginable between Bush and Gore, and ultimately went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the early stages of the September 11th plot. Both of these events were happening in the same time, in the same place, in Florida. And which I call the unlikely crucible of the future. So the idea is basically that while at the time the year 2000 seemed like a prosperous, placid time in which American geopolitical dominance was unchallenged, in fact, the seeds of the future were being sown.
Where were you in the year 2000?
I was actually working in New York as a young reporter for a newspaper called the New York Observer, which subsequently came to some public renown in subsequent years because it was owned by a young man named Jared Kushner. But in the time that I worked for it, it was owned by someone else. It was a young kind of puckish newspaper that covered the people and industries of New York City in a sort of cheeky and irreverent way, and it's the place where I got my start, where I covered the 2000 election, saw many of these events happen firsthand, and in fact got to know several of the characters who subsequently play a large role in my book, including Donald Trump, who at the time I got one of my the things I covered was commercial real estate. He was a sort of a regular source of mine. And during that year, he was running for president. So that was something that I and a lot of my colleagues were following quite closely, along with, you know, other events, political events that were going on during the year 2000, many of which ended up becoming part of the fabric of this book.
So you're still working as a journalist today. At what point along the time frame did this theory or thesis about the year 2000 being the pivotal year develop for you?
Well, I think I recognized it in the moment, in the sense that I think that many of us who were or pretty close to the moment, I think many of us who lived through the 2000 election and then the almost immediate kind of jarring, disruptive shocking event of September 11th, reflected on the fact that the stakes of the 2000 election seem much higher in retrospect than they seemed at the time. The idea of actually writing it as a book didn't really come to me until several years later, when after 2016, when having covered Donald Trump's unlikely rise to power, I started thinking about, having covered him during his first presidential campaign during 2000, I started thinking about all the sorts of pieces of the future that were falling into place during the year 2000, during this time when I was starting out as a journalist. And gradually the contours of the book came into shape for me, thinking about kind of the ways in which all of these events were interconnected and happening at the same time.
What was it like writing the book in another pivotal year, the coronavirus year?
Well, It was actually, I had a book leave that began at the beginning of February in 2020. I had a bit of reporting that I had to take care of in Florida in order to get started on writing the book. And I actually finished my last reporting trip on March 8th of 2020. I flew back to New York. People were already a little bit alarmed about these reports about what was happening in China, what was happening in Italy, but no one really knew what was going to happen. So my writing process really coincided with the pandemic and the progress of the pandemic. For a while, I was really shut down in my attic writing this book while the rest of the world sort of came to a standstill. And ultimately, you know, what ended up happening was I continued writing the book chronologically through 2020, writing about the events of the year 2000. And just the way things fell into place, I was writing about the presidential campaign of 2000 while the presidential campaign of 2020 was going on. I was writing about the recount and the legal battle over to determine the presidency during the aftermath of the 2020 election, and really sort of seeing the parallels between these two events come very much coming to the fore. I wouldn't have wished it for it to happen. I think the 2020 election was a horribly traumatic event for our country, but it was useful in a way to have a kind of reference point, a historical reference point that I was thinking about all the time as all these events were happening.
You described that there are five major storylines that weave their way through your book. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your writing style, because readers will find some very specific details. As an example, books that were in Osama bin Laden's hideout, or the actual meals ordered by the Bush and Gore attorneys after they argued the case at the Supreme Court. Where do you find that specific kind of information in your work, and what do you think it adds to your storytelling?
Well, I mean, I used all kinds of different source materials to pull together this book. I mean, there were everything from Freedom of Information Act requests that I used to write one particular portion of the story about an ATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms investigation involving a former Goldman Sachs bond trader who's a major character in this book, to court records, whether it's the court records of civil suits that arose from the Florida recount, or criminal cases, for instance, for the 9/11 portion, I used a lot of records from the military commission tribunals in Guantanamo Bay. And then there were other secondary source materials like books, obviously, but also oral histories. A lot of the people who I've been writing about have told versions of their stories in various different places. And as a journalist, I have a bit of an investigative bent as a journalist, and I often, you know, like to sort of find these little telling details inside very large piles of documents, and maybe that's one of the things that I've learned in my many years as a journalist, sort of how to find those little details that make the story come to life. So, you know, what people ate for dinner, or the specific itineraries of the 9/11 hijackers as they went through their flight training in Florida, or where they shopped when they were living there. All these sorts of things were things that could be found in the documentary record, and I think helped to kind of create a more novelistic type of narrative that draws in a reader and makes the reader feel as if the story is happening in real time.
Well, let's dig in a little bit more to the story that you tell. So coming into the new millennium, what was the state of the nation?
Well, I think it's really telling at this historical moment, you know, as we're all watching the war in Ukraine and sort of seeing this period of great geopolitical upheaval, largely, I think, created because of a rising from a sense that American power is waning and on the world stage, or at least has been called into question on the world stage. In the year 2000, the America's position in the world was really one of predominant, had a predominant position in the world. People were seriously talking about the triumph of liberal democracy, the idea that that Russia, China, and all these other countries were sort of inevitably marching towards a sort of endpoint, the end of history, as Frank Fukuyama called it, in which, you know, all the nations of the world would embrace liberal democracy. It was a time of great prosperity. There was a $4 trillion surplus. A lot of the political polarization of the of earlier eras in American history had waned. The two parties were considered to be almost sort of interchangeable at that time period. So it was really a placid interlude that during which a lot of people thought politics and the presidential election and geopolitics and faraway foreign policy crises didn't really matter to their lives. But of course, as I show in the book, all of these things had a tremendously consequential effect on America and on people's lives.
One specific thing that you note is that December 31st, 1999 is the day that Vladimir Putin came into power. Was it a remarkable event? Was it considered remarkable at the time?
It was shocking. If you look at the front pages of the newspapers, every newspaper in the world, essentially, there were, you know, the lead headline, for instance, in the New York Times was just a giant date, 1100, and pictures of people celebrating around the world. On the left column, on the front page, there was a front page article about Boris Yeltsin surprising Russia by resigning early in a speech delivered from the Kremlin and handing power to a then unknown colorless bureaucrat named Vladimir Putin, who was widely presumed during that time period to probably be a sort of caretaker figure. And it wasn't until much later that the consequences of that change of power became evident to everyone.
Two things that the world was on knife's edge about as the new millennium dawned. One was the Y2K global computer meltdown that people were afraid of, and the other actually was terrorism, including that, as you remind people, many of the New Year's Eve celebrations globally were canceled because of fear of terrorism. Neither of those things played out. So then what happened afterwards?
Well, you know, there's a sort of ironic joke in the book that I make towards the end of the book, that the people who predicted a grand cataclysmic event bringing the 20th century to an end with Y2K, with this computer bug that many people thought was going to spell the end of modernity. You know, I said those people who the doomsayers weren't completely wrong. There was a grand cataclysmic event. It just didn't quite happen on the calendar schedule. The grand cataclysmic event, of course, being the September 11th attacks that fundamentally realigned the world. So my book is really about what happened in between those two events, between the predicted catastrophe and the actual catastrophe. What happened between those two events, as I said, is a kind of a period in which the pieces of the future were falling into place, in which George W. Bush and Al Gore fought for the presidency in what turned out to be a very incredibly close and incredibly consequential election, and a time period in which American society was really changing in a variety of really profound ways. You know, one of the subplots in the book involves, as I think you've alluded to already, involves the Elian Gonzalez controversy, which was not just it was the biggest news event in America for about 4 or 5 months in early 2000, but was also a kind of formative moment in the development of our modern media culture. This media culture in which it seems as if the entire nation is transfixed by passing episodic kind of obsessive, binge-worthy dramas, and these sorts of real life dramas, whether they be, you know, on whether they be packaged as entertainment, as reality TV, or packaged as news, as reality, this is the way that we kind of entertain ourselves, and the way in which we experience history at this point is in these really sort of all-consuming media events. And that really began in the year 2000 with the Elian Gonzalez controversy, and later with the recount.
If Florida is the, as you called it, a crucible or centerpiece of your story, was Florida ripe for this role? Was there something special about Florida that put it into this set of circumstances?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of it is, of course, a product of historical coincidence that, you know, say, for instance, that the all the things that had to fall into place in order for Florida to assume this pivotal role in the 2000 election, you had to have all that. Some of your viewers may not even remember exactly what happened in the 2000 election. I found younger people don't always know all the details. So, you know, what essentially happened is Gore won the popular vote. Bush lost by about 500,000 votes in the popular vote, but the way that the Electoral College fell out, essentially it was a tie in the Electoral College, with Florida occupying the deciding role. You know, whoever won Florida was going to win the election, and then it came down to this minuscule number of votes in Florida, just a few hundred, or at times a few thousand votes, separating the two candidates as they fought back and forth over these legal battles. So really there was an element of kind of incredibly improbable circumstance that threw Florida into this place. But as I also say in the story, you know, Florida was it was serendipitous in a way that Florida occupied this role, because it really was the place that the rest of America was becoming. It had both a kind of conservative, white working class population in the North. That was they call that area that the Redneck Riviera around the Panhandle region and so on. And then in the south of Florida, you have this polyethnic, multicultural, multilingual, very diverse, and also very, you know, sort of chaotic South Florida political culture. So you have, you know, in this one place, a lot of the elements that we now recognize as being sort of part of our political culture in America today, you know, encapsulated in a small place. The ironic part of it is that at the time, people considered this, you know, Florida a big joke. They called it Florida, spelled D-U-H. You know, the idea was that Florida was a state that just couldn't get it right. And Florida was the state that you really couldn't trust to decide anything. Of course, in the end, the joke ended up being on everybody else.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So, Elian Gonzalez, who we've referenced a few times, what's a brief capsule of his story? Who was he, and why did he become such a cause celeb?
So, my book, actually, one of the threads that I guess begin the book is, it begins with a journey. This journey began around late November of 1999. A group of a dozen or so Cuban refugees packed onto a flimsy boat and set sail for Miami under the prevailing policy of the time. Cubans who made it to Miami on boats would be given asylum, would be put on a fast track to citizenship. It was well known in Cuba, which at the time was suffering under extremely stringent U.S. sanctions. It was well known that, you know, if you could just make it to Miami, there would be a better life waiting for you there. So this group of about around a dozen Cubans set sail. They hit the boat was not really seaworthy. They hit a storm. The boat ultimately ended up capsizing. Most of them died. One young boy miraculously was found on Thanksgiving Day, 1999, clinging to an inner tube off of the coast of Florida, near not far from Miami. He's brought to shore and taken to live with his relatives, his extended relatives. His mother had died, but his father's relative on the boat. But his father's relatives were living in Florida, welcomed him in, pledged to raise him, you know, as their own son. The problem that arose was that his father was still alive, and his father was in Cuba. His father didn't want him to go back. Didn't want him to continue living in the United States. He wanted to be reunited with his son, understandably, and he wanted to stay in Cuba because he had a life there. He didn't want to emigrate. He was estranged from Elian's mother, and what ensued was this incredible custody battle where the relatives in Miami asserted that they knew what was best for the boy, that they were upholding the dying wishes of his mother, who had given her life to take him to the United States. The boy's father, backed by Fidel Castro and ultimately by the Clinton administration and his Attorney General Janet Reno, Miami native, who figures really large in my story, they basically backed the rights of the father, became a gigantic standoff, legal standoff and political standoff that ultimately was only resolved when Janet Reno ordered a raid on the boy's house and on the Miami relative's house in Little Havana that yielded a sort of indelible image of a Border Patrol agent with a submachine gun pointing at it in the general direction of the boy. And this became this was an unforgettable image that ultimately ended up helping to cost Al Gore the election, because it drove an enormous Cuban turnout in Miami on election day, largely turning out for George W. Bush and indisputably helping Bush to carry the state of Florida by the narrowest possible margin of 537 votes.
We have a brief clip, 36 seconds, of President Clinton talking about the Elian Gonzalez raid from April of 2000. We're going to watch now.
The Department of Justice, under the leadership of Attorney General Reno, went to great lengths to negotiate a voluntary transfer. Even yesterday, the Attorney General worked very hard on this late into the night, showing great restraint, patience, and compassion. When all efforts failed, there was no alternative but to enforce the decision of the INS and a federal court that Juan Miguel Gonzalez should have custody of his son. The law has been upheld, and that was the right thing to do.
But you tell a story behind the scenes, both of Attorney General Janet Reno and the angst at the White House about the process she was taking. So with the hindsight of 20 years, what mistakes did she make in approaching the crisis?
Well, I think that the, you know, before we talk about the mistakes, I think we should give her credit for the what she was attempting to do, which was, you know, she was from Miami. She had formerly been an elected prosecutor in Miami, and she felt as if she had was sort of perfectly situated to resolve this unresolvable crisis. She was somebody who was, Janet Reno was somebody who was extremely dedicated to the rights of welfare of children. This was one of her signature causes throughout her entire life. And so when presented with this case of this child whose fate was being tugged and argued back and forth by presidential candidates, by his family, by the entire American public, Janet Reno thought that she was the person who could, perhaps the alone was the person who could solve the problem. What ended up happening, of course, is that all of her best intentions ended up backfiring because her involvement really elevated the crisis, emboldened the Cuban exiles in Miami, and made it a kind of political issue that the Republicans, and including the George W. Bush's campaign, and you know, under the partial guidance of Bush's brother Jeb, who was the governor of Florida, well acquainted with the political dynamics of South Florida, basically because Reno elevated it into this enormous national issue, or helped to elevate it into this enormous national issue, the Republicans recognized that it was a extremely salient political issue that would potentially help them to win Florida in the presidential election that was then coming up in 2000. So really it was one of these cases where the road to perdition, I guess, was paved with very good intentions on her part. Unfortunately, it did not turn out well for anyone, except arguably for Elian, because Elian did eventually go back to live with his father, and ultimately he now lives in Cuba and has expressed great gratitude to. Ultimately, to the people who returned him to his father, because he did not want, as an adult, he says that he did not want to live his life in Miami with this group of extended relatives, but rather with his nuclear family in Cuba.
Considering the political stakes, did both of the candidates, Bush and Gore, have a position on Elian Gonzalez?
Yes, Bush's was very clear. Bush, like most members of the Republican Party, felt that made the case that Elian should remain in the United States. Bush quite memorably suggested that Elian's father come and be granted asylum as well. He said, "You know, we'll give this man a whiff of freedom." He said. In his Texas twang, which I won't try to imitate, and that, you know, once he had this whiff of freedom, he would undoubtedly want to stay in the United States permanently. Now that didn't ultimately end up happening. Juan Miguel did come to retrieve his son and did not want to stay in the United States. So Bush was wrong about that, but his position was clear. Al Gore had a very tortured position, which was actually, as I say in the book, was sort of was of a piece with his larger political problem of always trying to find the sort of perfectly calibrated political response to any given situation. his position was that he had a bunch of different positions that he adopted, but the one that he ultimately adopted was more similar to Bush's and the Republicans than to Clinton's, which ultimately ended up causing him a lot of problems because he appeared to be repudiating his own administration, which angered a lot of Democrats, while he didn't really get any credit whatsoever from the Cubans in Miami or from the Republican Party. And as a result, his advisors later blamed his difficulties in the polls in the early spring and summer of 2000, when he trailed Bush by a substantial margin before coming back. They attributed a lot of that difficulty that he was having to people's basically his too cute by half response to the Elian Gonzalez controversy and the way in which it made many people think that he was insincere or politically calculating.
So if this book is the lead up to the 9/11 attacks, just a couple of questions. We're at the halfway point of our hour together. You tell the story of the lead up to the attacks through the eyes of one of the 9/11 attackers, Ziad Jarrah. Who was he and why did you choose him?
Jarrah was a young Lebanese man. He was 24 years old, maybe, when he originally set off on his journey as that would end in his death on September 11th, along with the death of many other innocent people. He was not an innocent person, but the death of many innocent people. Came from a wealthy family, was a cultured person, had attended Christian schools and in Beirut, even though he was himself a Muslim. He was a sort of person who was what we would maybe call at that time, quote unquote, Westernized. He would drink. He had a girlfriend who, when he lived in, he went to Germany to study, and he had a girlfriend there who was of Turkish extraction. She was not herself very religious, and at some point in his early 20s, he fell in with a group of young men at a mosque in Hamburg. Became very devout, very religious. People noted a kind of transformation in him around this time. And he ultimately ended up with a group of three other individuals from his mosque in Hamburg, went on a journey. As I point out in the book, as sort of a historical coincidence of sorts, his journey to Afghanistan started on Thanksgiving Day, November 25th, 1999. So really the same day that Elian Gonzalez arrived in Florida, he also set out on a journey. His journey took him to Afghanistan, where he initially, along with his comrades or fellow members of his cell in Hamburg, as it was later called, but really just a group of friends, initially wanted to volunteer to fight on the front lines in the Afghan Civil War. But he and his friends were quite quickly identified by Osama bin Laden's lieutenants, who were always on the lookout for potential recruits who could be used for missions in the West. They were identified as having sort of a special and, in fact, almost unique set of skills that would make them the almost perfect group of people to try to give this assignment of carrying out what was called the Plains Operation. This all happened in a very, very short period of time during Ramadan in 1999, which is December 1999 and early January 2000. These individuals came to Afghanistan. They were recruited within a few weeks. They were sort of inducted into Al-Qaeda. They met Osama bin Laden. They accepted their mission, their suicide mission, to and were basically given the rudiments of the plan to attack the United States. But really, they left in mid-January of 2000, had very little contact after that with anyone from Al-Qaeda. And they were really the people who were responsible for planning carrying out the conceptual idea of the 9/11 attacks. One of the major things that I found fascinating in the course of doing this was the degree to which, although in the historical common historical memory, it's Osama bin Laden or Khalid Sheikh Mohammed who are typically referred to as the architects or the masterminds of the 9/11 attacks. What I thought was quite interesting was that Zia Jarrah and Mohammed Atta and a couple of other individuals that he was close to in Hamburg, they really were the people who planned and carried out these attacks themselves. They were the architects of the attack were really the people who carried it out. And I thought it was quite interesting to understand their motivations. And even in Jarrah's case, conflicts, internal conflicts that he experienced right up until the moment, really almost the moment that the attack was launched, internal struggles as to whether he wanted to continue on, he wanted to carry out the attack. Many times he almost left, and ultimately he was talked back into it by his fellow perpetrators. And no one can really say what truly motivated him, but what we can say is that it's an interestingly human story about an unhumanly evil act.
I do want to get to the election, which is really what the book is all focused on. But one last question about Osama bin Laden. There are several times in your narrative where you depict the national security team in the Clinton White House, who is well aware of the threat of Osama bin Laden, as debating about whether or not to pull the trigger. Why ultimately did they not ever do that?
Well, I think that there was, I mean, it's quaint to think it now, but I think that there was a reluctance on the part of some people within the Clinton administration, Janet Reno being one of them, to take that step toward that would have many of the plans involved kidnap operations that were really, you know, not which were anticipated, which were essentially assassination operations in all but name. They were the CIA was anticipating resistance, and that resistance would end with the death of Osama bin Laden, and perhaps many other young children, innocent women, and so on, and there was trepidation within the Clinton foreign policy or national security team at that time about whether this would be a step too far, whether this was a step that would be contrary to American values. One of those values at the time was that the United States didn't order assassinations, even against people who were clear sworn enemies of the United States. So ultimately, I think there was a lot of internal struggle between the sort of the lawgivers, you might call them, Janet Reno foremost among them, or the people who were believed that the highest value was the rule of law, and the people who were thinking more about, you know, the results and the threats and what potentially Al-Qaeda could do. And it wasn't so much that the Janet Reno and her faction won these arguments as they just managed to kind of stretch the decision-making process out long enough that the election intervened. And by the end, by October 2000, when the attack on the USS, the warship USS Cole happened, a lot of these conversations came to a head. And Bill Clinton decided at that point, you know what, there's going to be an election. We can set this aside and let's not do something that would maybe cause political blowback right in the midst of an election campaign. And then, you know, after the recount period was finished, There was only a very brief period of time. And ultimately, the Clinton administration decided, well, we'll let the next guy deal with it. And, you know, unfortunately, the next guy didn't deal with it or didn't deal with it promptly enough to avert the 9/11 attacks.
Moving on to the election, let's talk about Donald Trump. You talk about his 2000 campaign as a run that has essentially been, quote, airbrushed out of history. We have Donald Trump on January 5th, 2000, talking about his potential campaign.
I think it's something that's turned out to be very serious. If you look at the crowds, if you look at our internal poll numbers have been amazing. The ratings on television have been the highest of anyone by far. So if you look at the various numbers, I think, you know, people have now seen that this has become very real. I'm going to make a decision on probably during the month of February, and that'll be based on whether or not I think I can win. I'm not looking to get 20% of the vote. If I think I can win, we may very well have a very positive decision.
His vehicle that he was contemplating was the Reform Party. The 20% was a reference to the 19%+ that Ross Perot had gotten as a Reform Party candidate in earlier election. And I'm wondering, since you covered Donald Trump, how much did the tenets of the Reform Party in 2000 connect with the Donald Trump you knew and his politics?
Well, this is, you know, again, one of the historical ironies of this whole story, which is that, as you can hear even in that clip, the Donald Trump of 2000 sounds exactly like the Donald Trump of 2016, the Donald Trump of 2020, and perhaps the Donald Trump of 2024. The difference between Donald Trump in 2000 and Donald Trump in these later years is that he didn't really have anything to say. His as you could hear him saying that in that clip, he's talking about poll numbers. He's talking about his popularity. He's talking about his celebrity. He's talking about the public response to his efforts to begin a presidential campaign. You know, all of this is very familiar, but he didn't have an ideology. He essentially, his ideology was a kind of you know, vote for me, I'm famous. There was another candidate who was running, however, within the Reform Party, which a lot of people don't remember now, but the Reform Party was a third party that was begun by the followers of Ross Perot as a sort of vehicle for his third party presidential campaigns in 1992 and 1996, in which he ran as a kind of budget slashing populist. And there was a group that the Reform Party, the core of the Reform Party, is actually very much the same group of people ideologically that we now think of as the Trump base or the Republican base. These are people who are anti-trade agreements. These are people who are talk about things like restrictive immigration policies and retributive law and order policies and so on. And they actually had a candidate who spoke their language in that campaign in 2000. His name was Pat Buchanan, and he was the guy that Donald Trump ran against and ultimately, you know, lost to. He or pulled out in lieu of losing to. The Buchanan at that time, his slogan was America First. He talked about building a wall or building a barrier along the border with Mexico. He talked very much about, you know, how America's Judeo-Christian fundamental character was under threat from outsiders and as he referred to sort of invaders from other nations. This is all stuff that we now associate with the Donald Trump's wing of the Republican Party. At the time, Donald Trump attacked Pat Buchanan in his typical fashion he called him a Hitler lover. He called his followers weirdos. You know, the historical irony is that 16 years later, a lot of those same people who supported Pat Buchanan ended up becoming the most core fervent supporters of Donald Trump.
On election day, Pat Buchanan, who was the ultimate Reform Party nominee, got less than 1% of the vote. But just to advance our story, what did happen is that his name on Palm Beach County, Florida's butterfly ballots became a real source of the ensuing argument, debate, vote over who won the election. So let's, we have about 15 minutes left. Election day, November 7th, 2000, actually became election 6 weeks, lasting until December 13th when Al Gore conceded. You have a lot of the detail in the TikTok in your book, which people can find more about the characters and the strategies they employed. But I wanted to just ask you about one dramatic scene in the middle of the night on election night with Al Gore in a car ready to make a concession. What changed their mind about him doing that?
Well, it's one of the most famously pivotal moments in American electoral history, where Al Gore had called George W. Bush around 3 a.m. The networks had all declared that Bush had won Florida, thereby becoming president of the United States. There was, you know, the typical kind of hoopla and so on, you know, surrounding that those declarations around 3 a.m. Gore called, conceded to Bush. But meanwhile, there had been some there have been some glitches in the vote counting. In fact, one of the major ones that actually triggered the projection for Bush was later attributed to a broken memory card from a vote counting machine in one particular precinct in Daytona Beach area. Ultimately, this kind of triggered this projection for Bush. Gore conceded. Once the mistake was rectified, the distance between the two candidates became much smaller. And meanwhile, results were pouring in from other parts of the state that were very strong for Gore, where he showed, you know, unanticipated strength, places like Palm Beach County and so on, and ultimately brought the results within a few hundred votes as he was about to approach the stage in Nashville to give his concession speech. So his in the days before cell phones, he did not know this. And people were not able to get through to him in his limousine. So he actually, a staff member kind of almost had to wrestle him away from the stage, take him to a back room where he watched as the results came closer and closer, and ultimately made what was, you know, one of the most awkward phone calls in American history to George W. Bush, where he retracted his concession. And Bush reacted very negatively to it. Al Gore famously replied, you don't have to get snippy about it.
If you told the story of Elian Gonzalez and the impact on the Cuban-American vote in South Florida, one other character to put in here, which became important to the closeness of this, was Jesse Jackson. Reverend Jesse Jackson, who campaigned very vigorously to get the African-American vote out in the election. And he also played a role in the recount process in his counseling with Al Gore. Tell that story, please.
Well, this is one of the lesser known or lesser told parts of the recount story. While a lot of the focus subsequently, understandably, was on from the media and the campaigns was on a handful of ballot malfunctions, including the one you referenced earlier, the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach, where mistakenly a lot of voters, many of them elderly Jewish voters, ended up by accident voting for Pat Buchanan because of a faulty ballot design. There was a much larger story whether inadvertent or deliberate disenfranchisement of voters of color in Florida, who turned out in really huge numbers for Gore on election day. A later study by a federal civil rights commission estimated that 1 in 7 black voters' ballots were invalidated for one reason or another on election day, largely because of technical mistakes or other ballot design flaws that caused them to either not have a vote registered at all or to inadvertently vote for for two different presidential candidates, thereby invalidating their vote. Jesse Jackson showed up, during this time period, the foremost civil rights voice in the country was Jesse Jackson. He showed up in Florida and really tried to make this a big public issue. He staged a march in Palm Beach County, in which he was booed off the stage and ultimately kind of evacuated because there was concerns about safety by Republican supporters. And he was very much trying to say to the public that he felt that there was something that didn't seem right about the election results, that he thought the election had been in fact stolen from the Democrats. Gore did not, and maybe we can look at this decision by Gore in retrospect and understand it or view it in more favorable light now in light of 2020 and the consequences of it. But Gore basically told Jesse Jackson, no, I really want, I want to calm this down. I do not want to talk about this rhetoric of a stolen election. I do not want to talk about racial disenfranchisement publicly and raise fears of, or raise race as an issue in this election. And that was sort of a card that he chose not to play in the course of the recount. And I think many of his advisors and certainly Jesse Jackson think in retrospect that was a mistake.
So ultimately, of course, the election landed in the hands of the Supreme Court in two cases. First, Bush v. Palm Beach County Canvassing Board, and then ultimately Bush v. Gore, which they heard in oral argument. And you have some private conversations reported in your book between members of the court about the case. How were you able to get that sort of information? Had they spoken about it publicly afterwards?
Well, this is where, in this particular narrow case, a lot of my a lot of what I have in my book is dependent on the work, which I, of course, footnote and attribute that other journalists have done. Evan Thomas wrote a biography of Sandra Day O'Connor that's excellent, that relied heavily on her papers. Justice John Paul Stevens, before his death, wrote a memoir in which he gave some, retrospective color to the court's internal deliberations. There, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, prior to her death, spoke publicly at a public forum about, what she called that day, the one day when Bush v. Gore was decided, and the way in which the justices were kind of going around and almost sort of trading favors like word healers with one another, and trying to negotiate their opinions in a more nakedly political way than they customarily do. And then finally, there was quite a bit of investigative reporting done on this subject by journalists in the aftermath, that a lot of the clerks, especially the clerks of the liberal justices, were quite upset about Bush v. Gore. Some of them in a rare breach of their code of omerta that they take as Supreme Court clerks. Some of them did talk with Vanity Fair a few years later about the court's internal deliberations during that weekend. So using all of these sources, and then there were oral histories and so on that many of the lawyers and other major protagonists in the case had given. So using all of these kinds of historical records, I was able to weave together a lot of the internal TikTok of the court's deliberations.
So, Andrew, we have 5 minutes left, and so much more we would dig into here. But let me just kind of ask wrap up questions about this. So, with the hindsight of 20 years, how does Al Gore's decision to concede, which even after the court case, you report that some of his internal advisors were arguing against, how does that decision look with 20 years hindsight?
Well, I think that the, you know, with 19 years of hindsight, when I started writing the book, it looked a lot different than it did with 20 years of hindsight, which is to say that everything looked much different in light of 2020. I think that, you know, Gore's decision not to continue to contest the validity of the election, his decision to ultimately concede the election, and not to cast doubt on the legitimacy of his opponent, George W. Bush, even though I think Al Gore, if you hooked him up to a lie detector and asked him who he thought won the election, he would tell you that he thought that he did. His decision ultimately was that he thought that the legitimacy of the office of the presidency was too important to potentially squander by casting doubt on the result of the election. He believed that the transition of power was something that was more important than his own personal power. And ultimately, he made a huge sacrifice in terms of his own ego and his own political ambitions, in terms of saying, you know what, I think we fought long enough. Now, he of course wanted to preserve his political viability for the future, and he was still a young man thinking about possibly running again in 2004. So it wasn't completely a selfless act. But that said, it still took a lot to concede. And you know, at the time, we took it as a given that the loser would ultimately concede the election, no matter how unfair it seemed to his supporters. But as we've seen, unfortunately, in history since then, it's not a given. And in fact, the consequences of not doing that can be really profoundly awful.
If, as you declared, 2000 was the year that broke America, what ultimately do you see as the impact of what happened that year on this country?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, with the benefit of 20 years of retrospect, we can see a couple of things tracing all the way back to the year 2000. I mean, the first one is that the American dominance on the international stage and American prosperity, the acknowledgement of liberal democracy and American-led globalization as the norm for all nations, that's something that began to wane after September 11th, after the shocking attack on the World Trade Centers and the subsequent many decade long military engagements that drained so many moral, political, and financial resources from this nation. And I think that the other really consequential event that we can trace back to 2000 is this idea, as I alluded to a moment ago when I was talking about Gore, this idea that the institutional authority of the Supreme Court, of the electoral system, of democracy itself here in the United States never really fully recovered from 2000. Since 2000, there really hasn't been a presidential election that hasn't been surrounded by claims of illegitimacy. John Kerry supporters claim that some John Kerry supporters claim that there was electoral shenanigans in Ohio that cost him the election in 2004. In 2008, many Republicans believe that Barack Obama was illegitimately elected because they believed a racist conspiracy theory about his birth. In 2016, the foremost proponent of that racist conspiracy theory became president. And the Democrats ended up spending several years trying to prove that, you know, the Donald Trump's election was engineered by a foreign power, that being Russia. And, you know, when Trump was elected in 2020, well, we all know what happened, and culminating in the storming of the Capitol on January 6th. So it's hard to foresee a scenario in which in the near future, at least, an election is likely to result in the election of a truly a president that's considered legitimate by all Americans. And that's a really profound change for the worse that I think traces back to this period in 2000. That said, As I always say, you know, because it just because something that's broken can always be fixed again. I do think that there's a way back to a different, more more idyllic period, or a better, more democratic period, like the one that we experienced prior to the year 2000. And you know, it's hard to see how we get there right now, but I think one of the ways in which we start to get there is look at how things went wrong and how we might correct them in the future.
Journalist Andrew Rice's new book, The Year That Broke America, with perhaps the longest subtitle of any author I've interviewed, An Immigration Crisis, A Terrorist Conspiracy, The Summer of Survivor, A Ridiculous Fake Billionaire, A Fight for Florida, and The 537 Votes That Changed Everything. Thanks for spending an hour with C-SPAN.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to C-SPAN's Q&A, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're there, please take a minute to rate and review us. You can also send us an email about Q&A at podcasts@c-span.org. Send me your questions, your comments, or ideas. Your feedback is welcome.